Am I in charge?
Well, well, here we go then, straight away. This is me. My day job is a professor of applied mathematics at Portsmouth University, and it's something I've been doing for the last 30 or so years, looking at mechanics. I'm an applied mathematician, so I want to know how the universe works, and predict what's going on. More about that later. But I'm going to talk about these things here, chaos and fractals. So I want to talk about things that move like this, and not like this, this pendulum here. A bit more about that in a minute. And also things that look like this, a bit weird here, these strange geometrical shapes, which I'm going to call fractals. I'll say a bit about that word and where that comes from. So I'm going to talk about chaos and fractals, things that move in a strange way, and things which look a bit weird. That sounds very sort of very cavalier, isn't it? So the takeaway messages for you, which I'll repeat at the end, are the following. Does the world behave like clockwork, like this pendulum at the front here is doing? And my answer to that question is going to be no. It's what I'm going to call chaotic. And the second question is the world made up of straight lines, squares, rectangles, circles, triangles, and so forth, these ancient Greek, these classical geometrical objects? And the answer to that is going to be no, that the geometry of nature is fractal. That's a very bold statement, but I'll show you pictorially what I mean by that. And I'll show you a few little mathematical toys that we use to try to tease out some of the intricacies of both these ideas, chaos and fractals. So that's not me at work. That's a classical view of creating the world. This is William Blake's picture of Isaac Newton. I'm not naked at work, drawing my objects here, my triangles and my set circles, semicircles using compasses, but this is the classical view of the architect here, in this case Newton, as seen in the Tate Gallery here, using compasses to design the universe. What I'm quite taken aback by is the next picture, though, which is actually a 13th century picture. It's in Vienna, in the museum in Austria there, of God as the architect of the universe, again with the compasses, this ancient Greek tool, drawing, measuring circles and so forth. Greeks were all into straight edges and compasses to draw circles and so forth. And our image of God as the architect is such. But I'm particularly fascinated by this picture here of God creates sky, earth, sun, moon and all elements. And I'm particularly struck by how messy this particular image of the universe is here. And there's a zoom in, there's a blow up of that bit. You can see these really sort of weird, strange shape here of this artist drawing the planets and the sun around this image, but there's this kind of weirdness here that already in the 13th century was there in our depiction of how God might create the universe. So what's chaos? If you look in the dictionary, you find something like this, and there's a couple of distinct meanings that we use, but the original is this gaping void. I'll read this out. A gaping void, an empty, immeasurable space there, an abyss that which gapes wide open, that which is vast and empty. That's the original meaning of chaos. You can understand where, in terms of the creation, what that might be implying for us. But since the 1600s now, it means utter confusion. Yeah, I promised Stuart not to mention Brexit at this point. I think you mentioned that in your little advert for this thing. That's all I'm going to say about that topic. No politics here. But nowadays, chaos is utter confusion. And this is from a theological use of chaos in Genesis there, 1530s there. You can see the void at the beginning of creation, the confused, formless, elementary state of the universe. But now we use chaos for this utter confusion, and that's what we're going to talk about here, from a more mathematical or physics sort of sense of chaos. So I want to take you on a little historical trip from the ancient Greeks, the masters there, through Galileo, through Newton, to today, to say how science evolves there. Of course, much, much else is going on as well, and we shouldn't be so Western-centric. Lots of great stuff happened in India, in the Far East, in China, in the Arabic countries as well, in terms of the development of science. Indeed, our very numbers that we write with are Arabic in nature there. Those who've heard of Fibonacci and his numbers and his rabbits, actually Fibonacci's greatest gift to science was to give us our decimal numerals that he stole from Indians and Arabic cultures there. But I'm going to talk about the classical timeline as we read it in the West. The ancient Greeks, we can rattle off who the ancient Greek players are, Apollonius, Euclid, Pythagoras, and so forth. Eratosthenes, famous for measuring the circumference of the earth, way, way back, 200 or 300 years BC. But the master of the ancient Greeks, of course, is Archimedes, sometimes called the greatest scientist ever. He's an engineer, a physicist, an astronomer, a mathematician, an inventor of all sorts of things. What we know about him for, of course, is the apocryphal story of Eureka, the Eureka moment. He was in Syracuse, which is in Sicily, but part of the Greek Empire there. And the king of Syracuse gave him the task of trying to determine whether a crown that he had, he'd given a load of gold to a crown maker, and he wasn't so sure whether this crown maker had put some silver in to sort of dilute the amount of gold, as it were, and keep the gold to himself. So the king of Syracuse gave Archimedes the task of trying to figure out whether this crown was pure gold. You won't melt it down, you see what happens, of course, that spoils the whole idea of this crown. So Archimedes was given this task of trying to determine whether this was a pure gold crown. And to the great frustration of his wife, he spent weeks and weeks trying to solve this problem for the king there, is this crown really made of gold? How can I do it? I can't destroy the crown and see what it's made of. But after his wife got on him over and over again to say, look, Archimedes, just chill out, go and take a bath. You know the story. He realized that what he was displacing was the weight of himself. And so, naked through the streets of Syracuse, he ran out shouting, Eureka, Eureka! I found it. And that's a great Eureka moment in science, when Archimedes discovered the principle of flotation. Now, you all know the moral of that story.
No.
No. The moral of the story is do what the wife says. That's a great thing from Archimedes there. But he is the master, by far and away, Archimedes of the ancient Greeks. Taking us through to Galileo, I'll say a bit more about him. Again, often considered the father of modern science. And Newton, I'll say a bit more about as well. We're going to take on that little tour there. And we'll see some controversy along the way. But what we want to do, the ancient Greeks wanted to understand this lot, the planets, which you can see in the night sky there, and you can see the Milky Way in the night sky. Chris's son David gave us a marvellous talk about cosmology a few months ago there, and we have nowadays the Hubble telescope to draw us fantastic pictures of what's out there in the universe, and of course our technology has advanced so that we can actually send a man to the moon and come back as well. So this is really the triumph of the scientific method to understand the universe here, God's creation around us here. And that's one thing that's the classical imperative of science, to understand what we see around us there. And of course the scientific method goes on to help us construct things. Pyramids of ancient Egypt, or more recently our Millennium Bridge in London. I'm sure you all know the story there of the instability that when the maths was bad, as it were, the people marching across it in sync caused it to resonate, and so dampers had to be put on it. But science helps us build architectural edifices, our famous Spinnaker Tower, again a triumph of mathematics with its beautiful sail shape as well there. What else do we want to do? Well, we want to do banking electronically. So science now is the more modern stuff. All our communications now is based upon the scientific method as laid down by the ancient Greeks through the Renaissance period, Galileo, Newton's ideas, and so forth. We want to gamble, or we want to gamble respectably in the stock market there, and this is just science now, that the stock market is full of mathematicians and physicists there designing the algorithms to try to trade efficiently. You all know where this place is here, GCHQ, listening into us, our communications, and trying to protect us there, and of course there's also ethical implications about what's going on with our government communications headquarters and likewise its American and other counterparts there. But basically these places are stuffed full of physicists, mathematicians there, people with the training in the scientific method to try to make these things work there. Unless you're Donald Trump, casino is not going to lose money. There's the other thing, you know, and it's because of the mathematical use of probability theory to ensure that whatever odds you're giving are going to make sure that the casino always has that edge. What do we do? Well, going way back to Galileo and others, ballistics. One of Galileo's great things was to try to look at military matters and try to see how you could fire projectiles certain distances, optimize that. What do we do nowadays? We want to have our smartphones, our wireless charging, And these are chock-a-block full of mathematical algorithms. I'll say a bit towards the end about how we can use our devices efficiently to send images across the world. We want to decide, we want to do logistics. We want to design passenger rail transport timetables. We want to be able to unload our cargo ship. I read recently the largest cargo ship in the world has 20,000 containers on it as it goes around the ocean. This is pathetic in size compared to that. Imagine what happens when that goes on quayside there. Somebody's going to decide how to unload those, where to put them, how to put them sensibly for onward transmission by rail or by road or whatever. And that's a mathematical, that's a scientific algorithm to try to do that in an efficient way. And more, we want to know about ourselves. And the Human Genome Project now tells us a lot about ourselves. It's a mathematical problem to try to understand our genetic makeup. And again, ethical implications are large in that, but hopefully we'll use our knowledge for benign purposes. Here's one of my favourite more modern applications of science. I like to tell my students this because it's well within their remit. Our first and second year students do their algebra, their vectors and their matrices and so forth, can understand Google's PageRank algorithm. Google's PageRank algorithm is what's made Google the last man standing in the search engine business. And this cartoon, literally this cartoon, is a kind of indication of how Google's, when you type a search term into your browser, how certain things are going to appear on the front page or high up on your list of search terms. And the idea is quite simple, that you are popular, this big yellow one here, if lots of people point to you. So you're going to, somebody thinks you're important. If lots of people think you're important, you're going to appear high up in the search results. But it's not just a matter of who, not just a matter of how many people are pointing to you. Like this blue one here has got lots of little minions pointing at it. It's also a matter of who is pointing to you. And so, for example, this red chap at the top here, there's only one person pointing to him, but look, he's quite big. He's a big fish in this sea. And he's a big fish because a really big fish thinks he's important. He's pointing to him. So it's a bit like saying, well, if the BBC think that your little web page here is important, then you are suddenly going to, other people are going to think you're important. And this little cartoon is going to evolve, and lots of people now will start to point to you, and you will grow even bigger. It's a kind of survival of the bigger get even bigger in this idea here. But in a nutshell, this is what Google search engine's all about. You measure how many people point to you, but you weight it by the significance of the person pointing to you as well. And when you kind of write yourself a nice little mathematical algorithm to do that, throwing in the statistics, you get yourself a multi-billion dollar piece of software called Google's PageRank algorithm. I was giving a talk about this a few months ago, and there was somebody from Microsoft in the audience. Now, is anybody Microsoft? And you can share this question. Microsoft have Bing as their search engine, which you may have heard of. So, suitably chastised, I revised my talk and talked about search engines and said, well, we've got Google and we've got Bing, and if you don't know what Bing is, then you should go and Google it. The idea is now Google is last man standing, as I say. It's the verb we use, like Hoover. We don't vacuum floors, we Hoover floors. We don't go searching for terms, we go Googling for terms because of the power there. But really, this is a fantastic application and not particularly sophisticated mathematics. As I said, I can teach my first or second year students how to write themselves a little program to implement Google's PageRank, Google search algorithm. Enough of that. Let me just wind back a little bit then to talk about astronomy, which is a spur for a lot of the science that we have today, and a lot of controversy along the way as well, of course. And it's worth pausing to say a few words about some of the controversies that are there. The ancient Greeks thought that the planets moved around the sun, but that didn't fit in particular with the religious wisdom of the Renaissance period in particular. We'll talk about Galileo in a second, but if you do try to put the Earth at the centre of things, then, and look what Mars does, then Mars goes around in this sort of spirograph-like pattern around the Earth, and that doesn't look particularly good. Now, that looks too complicated. So what Copernicus did, what the ancient Greeks did many, many years beforehand, was to come up with a heliocentric model. In fact, there was a hybrid model at the time as well, whereby everything went round the Earth, the Sun in particular, and the Moon, But the other planets went around the sun, which is going around the moon. It was a sort of a hybrid model of what's going on in the solar system to try to reconcile the geocentric view versus the heliocentric view, the sun at the centre view. But the great thing was that it was discovered that actually the planets do move in ellipses around the sun, and you can get away with it. You can get away from all this sort of strange dynamics of this sort of spiral. If you had a toy when you were younger, a spirograph, you'll recognise these patterns here. If you put the sun at the, not the centre, but at the focus of one of the ellipses, then here's an exaggerated picture to show what I mean by that. Then you get some quite beautiful, quite simple motions. And it's almost like this little pendulum that I've got here, that the planets are going round in a very regular way around the sun. So let's say a bit about the history. Of that. It was Copernicus who had the Renaissance era view of the sun at the centre. Tycho Brahe, the great Danish astronomer, also had great observations about this, and it was really, it's Kepler that we look to, who on basis of empirical data came up with the model of planets moving around in ellipses around the sun. A fantastic piece of science based on the data that Tycho Brahe was getting from his telescopes there. But as I said, the heliocentric view actually goes back 300-400 years BC, in fact, to the ancient Greeks. But then, of course, the man of the moment here is Galileo. And this is a sad tale for him. But I should say, because of his works, he's now known as the father of modern science. And in fact, not just his scientific efforts are important. He's a physicist, an astronomer, an engineer. As well, he's interested in particularly understanding about speed and gravity and velocity, projectile motions, I mentioned before, various military applications, pendulums as well, telescopes he invents. But his greatest gift to us, and why he's called the father of modern science, is because he thinks that you should analyse things mathematically, use equations in motion to try to understand things. And what he did was able to understand Kepler's laws from a mathematical point of view, and interpret what was going on there, a bit more about that in a moment. You may know a bit about the history here. He was subject to Inquisition. He was found, quotes, vehemently suspect of heresy for his heliocentric supporting views there, and he had to recant and was under house arrest for the rest of his life. It was actually only 1992 that Pope John Paul II expressed regret for the way Galileo was treated at the time there. His great quote there, Galileo, is mathematics is a language with which God wrote the universe. A very religious person, but clearly at odds with the authorities at the time there in his views. Stephen Hawking says, and Albert Einstein says the same thing actually, Galileo, perhaps more than any other single person, was responsible for the birth of modern science there. He is one of the outstanding figures in scientific history. His little quote there, it's actually the motto of, when I was in Italy for a year, this was actually the motto of the Italian parliament, E pur si muove, yet it moves. Despite all the mess that the Italian governments were into at the time, things were still going on, the economy was still going on, people were still going to school, people were still eating, yet it still moves, the Italian state still moves, despite the continual changes of governments there. What he actually meant, I think, Galileo, is yes, the Earth, he still believed that the Earth does move around the sun there, yet it still moves, is one of his famous quotes. So the scientific method, let me say some of my personal reflections on what we want to do following Galileo. What we do is we observe the world around us, we look around and see what's going on. And then we're not content with that, we try to predict what's going to happen next. And if you're an engineer, you want to do even more. I'm not going to say about this. You want to control what goes on as well. You want to build a dam somewhere, or you want to change something. You want to construct a device which has a certain function. I'm going to draw the line at just trying to predict what's going to happen next. And that's what mathematicians, applied mathematicians, try to do in the first instance. Yes, we want to control things as well, but in the first instance, physicists want to try to understand the world about us. And one of the goals there is to predict what's going to happen next. So the sort of thing you might want to do is, as a function of time, which is along the bottom axis here, see where you get to. And this particular graph here is quite oscillatory, it's jagging around a bit. I'll say a bit about where this comes from. This is an attempt to try to predict some feature of the weather here as time goes on. And you can see it's quite an erratic signal that we're seeing here for this particular piece of data here. So time along this axis here, and position where we are, whatever our variable is, our position or our speed or our pressure or our temperature, or whatever it might be here, then we want to try to see what it is in the future. And it's a great quote from this person. You may not have heard of Charles Kettering, an American inventor and engineer. He was the head of research at General Motors. Thanks to him, we have a starting motor in our cars. We have decent paint on our cars. He's the person responsible for putting lead into petrol in the first instance. Freon in fridges and air conditioning, he's responsible for that. He's the person who designed incubators as well, and many, many other patents. He's got several hundred patents there. But here's this great quote: "My interest is in the future because I'm going to spend the rest of my life there." Really, that's what I like about him. This is the front cover of Time magazine from 1933. Really one of the greatest inventors of American history there, Kettering, especially in the automobile industry. We want to know what's going to happen in the future, is the message here. So when it's like this, this pendulum here, I think we've got a pretty good idea of what's going to happen. And if we didn't have friction, then that would go on oscillating forever, this pendulum here. And indeed, that's our kind of mechanical view of the universe, like the planets going around the sun forevermore, we believe. So we want to observe what's going on and then move on to predict. And Galileo's great gift to us was to say, well, you do that prediction by using mathematics. The next character, arguably the greatest scientist ever, here is Isaac Newton, of course, here. He's the person who really took Galileo's message to heart, and in doing so, invented calculus, amongst other things, to help explain. He's famous for his laws of motion. I won't read them out. He's famous for his universal law of gravitation, which is the mathematics behind understanding Kepler's laws of planetary motion, the way the planets move in ellipses there, and looms large over all of science, not just in the UK, but in the world, of course. There, he is. If you read any biographies of Newton, you find out a lot more, much of which wasn't known at the time. But his more, more respectable activities were in science of optics and colour. It's thanks to him we know about the division of white light into the colours of the rainbow. He invented telescopes and many, many other things here, inventions to boot. He was a very devout Christian, Isaac Newton, but he was also very unorthodox as well. And his writings, which were not released until a couple of hundred years after his death, show some quite strange beliefs that he had, in particular denial of the Holy Trinity, for example, was one of his beliefs, which would have been absolutely is heretical still today, but at the time would have almost probably been fatal for him to declare that particular unorthodoxy. Very heretical, it seems, in his writings. He also dabbled in alchemy, trying to turn base metals into gold as well, again in secret, because it was not considered a respectable activity there. He was a great person in understanding biblical chronology as well. There, some great things that we learned from him, from his endeavours there. He was an MP a couple of times for Cambridge. Of course, he was knighted, and one of his other claims to fame was Master of the Royal Mint as well, a very important job at the time, which included having the life or death decisions to make over people who were abusing our currency. In Stephen Hawking's book, he begins by a little biography of Newton by saying, Isaac Newton was not a pleasant man. I think that's because of some of his activities over when he was in politics and working in the Royal Mint. But undoubtedly, he's considered to be the greatest genius who ever lived by many other scientists. Other thing about him, he went to Cambridge University in the early 60s, but he went back home to Woolsthorpe near Grantham in 1965 to escape the bubonic plague. And it was in that period, 1965, 1966, that he did all these great discoveries in the isolation he was in his manor up there, not too far from Nottingham, in his house. The story about the apple is semi-apocryphal. Yes, he claims that he did get some inspiration from seeing an apple drop. I don't think it drops on his head. There's no evidence of that. But his theories of gravity, he did make a remark somewhere in his writings about seeing an apple drop from one of the trees in his garden there. But certainly the greatest scientist we have, whose legacy lives large. Modern science really is still Newtonian, It's been added to since then by two particular 20th century developments. I'm not going to talk about them, but the theory of relativity from Einstein, one we want to explore when things are in the large or moving very fast, and the theory of quantum mechanics, one we want to explore when things are on a very small scale. Those are the two kind of triumphs of 20th century 20th century physics. But Newton's still there, and the legacy of Newton I'm going to talk about now in terms of chaos. So, the question is, do we have a clockwork universe? Is this pendulum that I've got here, I've got a 12-inch ruler, a fidget spinner, and a bit of blue tack. The most expensive thing here is this clamp that I got from our physics department here. Is the universe a clockwork universe? And we have clocks with pendulums, of course. If you're an engineer, you can build yourself a nice orrery, a model of the solar system there, wind it up, and the planets will go around the sun there. That's our mechanical view, our clockwork view of the universe. And you can try to understand us. This is Da Vinci's famous Vitruvian Man here. Not going to go down that route, but much as I said before about trying to understand DNA, maybe some people have a view that our mechanics are mechanical in some sense as well. I'm not going to comment on that. Well, this is the classical Newtonian view of the universe, that things behave like clockwork. So this is the view of the time from the great Laplace, one of the great physicists, mathematicians, inventor of probability theory, statistics here. And it's quite a wordy quote, but I will spend some time reading it here, which sums up the situation of Newton's mechanics. It says there, "We can regard the present state of the universe as the effect of its past and the cause of its future." So that means what went on in the past is going to determine the future. An intellect, and that's an interesting word he's using there, an intellect which at a certain moment knows the forces that set nature in motion and all the positions, everything of which nature is composed. In other words, if we know where we are now and if we know what's going to cause us to change, then if this intellect was vast enough to submit all this data to analysis, then I'll leave you to think whether this is a supercomputer or a divine being there, then this intellect would embrace in a single formula the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and those of the tiniest atom. So basically, you know what's going on for the future if you know what's happening now and you know, let's say, the equations of motion. And he says, "For such an intellect, nothing would be uncertain, and the future, just like the past, will be present before its eyes." So when I do my little pendulum here, imagine there's no friction, then I can tell you in 20 minutes' time where that pendulum's going to be. Or if I want to forecast the weather, then I just measure what the temperatures and pressures and all the data is now, and I imagine I've got the equations of motion which tell me what the weather is. I can give you a prediction of the weather for the future. Or more disturbingly, about the way we behave, if we believe that we are mechanical beings. And that certainly then gives us questions about the issue of determinism and free will. And again, I'm not a philosopher, so I don't want to comment upon that particular matter. But this is really summarizing the Newtonian view of the world, that if you know what's going on now and you know what's causing things to change, then you know the future. That's quite a disturbing prospect if you apply it to every aspect of your life. Well, here's a get out of jail card. My hero in my mathematical modeling, in my science, is Henri Poincaré, operating about 100 years later at the turn of the 19th century. Turn of the 20th century, sorry, late 1800s, early 1900s. And again, it's quite a wordy quote, for which I apologise, but I'm going to claim that this is our get-out-of-jail card for free will. Before doing that, I want to upgrade my pendulum by a great expense getting a 6-inch ruler, fidget spinner, and a bit of blue tack. I'm going to stick this on the bottom of this ruler here. So I've got 12-inch rule, 6-inch rule, and a couple of fidget spinners. Fidget spinners are great. You know, kids use these to get themselves de-stressed. They're great because the friction is so little in them. I'm going to let this thing go. Your job is to try to tell me when that little one at the bottom is going to flip over. It's got a bit of friction on it. Actually, I've stuck it down a bit harder. Let me loosen that a bit. That's better. little swingy toy at great expense, 12-inch ruler, 6-inch ruler, a couple of fidget spinners. Your job is to try to predict when it's going to flip over. It'd be pretty good if you can flip over which way it's going to flip over, let alone that. And your second job is to try to replicate that motion that I did, it's just done. So I kind of picked it up at a certain angle, and that one is a certain angle, and I let go. And that's written. If I try to do that again, if I try to get the same angle, I'm going to get it wrong. And even if I get myself a really smart measuring device to get that angle, then I'm still going to get it wrong because I can't do, you know, thousands of decimal places of accuracy to this thing. I'm going to get it wrong. And the future will be different. This is the get out of jail card that Poincaré writes about in the late 1800s here, the early 1900s. I'll read a bit of this. Again, following Laplace, if we know exactly the laws of nature and the situation where we are now, so if we know where we are now, we know what's going to make us move, that's where we begin, then we can predict exactly the situation of that universe at every succeeding moment. But the thing is, if that were the case, well, as you said, sorry, if that were the case, then the natural laws no longer have any secret for us. But the problem is, you can't know where you are now exactly. Well, this is our get out of jail card. He says, we could still only know the initial situation approximately. If that enabled us to predict the succeeding situation with the same approximation, that's all we require, and we would say the phenomenon has been predicted. In other words, it's governed by the laws of motion that are going to surely be at play in that simple toy. But here's a kicker. But it's not always so. It may happen that small differences in initial conditions produce great ones in the final phenomenon. A small error in the former will produce an enormous error in the latter. Prediction becomes impossible, and we have the fortuitous phenomenon, he wrote. He wrote it in French, of course, back then. This is what chaos is. Poincaré called it the fortuitous phenomenon here. So even 100 plus 120, 130 years or so ago, Poincaré was aware that we can't, the weather forecasters have a get out of jail card. Because you can't measure the temperature, pressure, whatever else you need everywhere in the world to infinite accuracy. There'll always be some errors in that. So you can let rip with your computer simulation, but because of things like this here, the strangeness of the behaviour here, you're not going to be able to predict what's going on after a long period of time. Yes, I can predict in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes time what's going on. In a day, maybe, for the weather. But ask me to do the weather forecast for 3 or 4 days' time, and it will be miserable. Somebody works at Met Office, somebody said before, didn't they? So, yeah, how did you get on? Met Office.
Well, they talked about long-range forecasting. Yeah. It's like a man firing a dart at a dartboard. The further away it is, the less accurate it is, you know. Long-range.
That's right. Well, here's my little toy to try to illustrate to you why you can't succeed in predicting the weather. Because you don't know exactly where you let rip, where you started off from with this particular, with this toy model. So Poincaré is the inventor of chaos, I would say, although he didn't call it that. Interesting to look at the timeline, by the way. Poincaré was about 100 years after Laplace, who in turn was about 100 years or so after Newton. This is a long time scale for these things to come evolved. So Newton's, we're talking about Newton still all the way here, and by the way, that was 100 years or so before that from Galileo, so we are talking in centuries in terms of development. But Poincaré's great works are still with us today, certainly one of the greatest physicists, mathematicians of the relatively modern era. The fortuitous phenomenon. So, this is the same chart I showed you before, but with two experiments on it. Time along the bottom, position along the top, along the side. And you can't see it, but the initial condition, the initial choice of, say, temperature, imagine this is temperature. We're trying to predict the temperature of something. It's not, but imagine it is. If you start off with a different reading on your thermometer by 0.001 difference, then the future looks pretty much the same for a while, but you can see after a while, you've radically diverged in where you are in terms of your prediction for the temperature. This is the idea of sensitive dependence on initial conditions. That tiny, tiny change in where you started causes a major change in where you end up. Our ultimate goal is to predict what's going to happen next, as I say there, but we must also worry about that imprecision, and if the sensitive dependence on initial conditions, then we're stuffed. We can't say what's going on in the future. You know this because it happens in life. And here's a great little quote. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of the horse, the rider was lost. For want of the rider, the battle was lost. For want of the battle, the kingdom was lost. All for the want of a horseshoe nail. This is attributed to Benjamin Franklin here. This tiny, tiny change that this particular horse not having a nail, this particular leg of this horse not having a nail to put the shoe in, causes the entire kingdom to be lost. That tiny, tiny change, one rider not being able to go to the battle, causes the kingdom to fall. That's the so-called butterfly effect, of course, which you've all been waiting for me to say. There, here we've seen the butterfly effect in my little toy pendulum here. The answer to that question is no. Of course, does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil cause a tornado in Texas? No, it doesn't, of course, because there'll be damping things that go on in the meanwhile. But the idea is the tiniest thing you can imagine in nature, this butterfly flapping its wings, can have a massive, massive effect, in this case on the weather, causing a tornado there. So this is just a nice little metaphor for this idea of sensitive dependence on initial conditions. Tiny, tiny things being different, a butterfly flapping its wings or not, causing a massive disturbance somewhere down the line. There. If you're a movie buff, like I am, you'll know the film Sliding Doors. Gwyneth Paltrow, John Hannah in it as well. And there's the poster for it has two versions of Helen. Gwyneth Paltrow, the main character. If you know the film, then it all hinges on the fact that she runs down the London Underground to catch her tube train, having left her boyfriend at home. And in one world, a little girl runs in front of her and spots her from getting on the tube carriage. In the other world, she manages to dodge this girl, gets on the tube. That tiny, tiny thing then, that little girl getting in her way as she's running down the steps to get on the tube train, causes her worlds to diverge. And the film's really nice. We sort of see two films then, in one, as it were, two lives of Helen, the main character, as one she has to go back to her flat, the other one she goes off to work and carries on as she intended that day. And her worlds diverge because of that that tiny, tiny incident there. That's a classic example of the butterfly effect. Americans aren't the most subtle of people. Here's a film, it's called The Butterfly Effect. Here, and the strapline there, change one thing, change everything there. So now this is in the popular culture, this so-called butterfly effect as well here. But that film, Sliders, is great. If you've not seen it, it's a really nice film with Gwyneth Paltrow as the main character, two characters in it. So, warning now, triangle. Going to do a bit of maths. The Mathematicians Trades Union would kick me out if I didn't do some maths. So I'm going to do some, but a bit like Sudoku, which has numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in it, you've got to put them in a place. The numbers don't matter in Sudoku. They could be A, B, C, D, E, you know that. There's nothing numerical in Sudoku, it's logic. And I'm going to do something logical now, although I'm going to use numbers as the vehicle to show you what chaos is through the kind of toys that we can play with to help illustrate chaos beyond our little pendulum, double pendulum thing there. So here's a game. Take a number as a decimal point, as a decimal expansion, point, blah, 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 whatever you want. And shift things along a bit. So in particular, times by 10 and throw away what's in front of the decimal point. So for example, 0.238, blah, 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 goes to 0.38, blah, blah, blah. Times by 10, you get 2 point something, and throw away that 2 and leave it as 0 point something. So 0.238746, my randomly chosen starting point, goes to 0.38746. So I'm going to pretend that this is a model of something in the world that's evolving, according to this strange rule. And it goes on again. So my 0.38746 goes to 0.8746, which goes to 0.746, which goes to 0.46, which goes to 0.6, which goes to, oh, don't know. I've lost total accuracy of where I am because the root source of my problem is I didn't specify where we started to enough decimal places. If I'd have put a few more things after that dot dot dot, or where that dot 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 is, I would have been able to tell you where we were after six goes. But notice I'm also losing accuracy as I go along as well, and the penultimate one, 0.6, there, if that had been not 0.238746, but 238745, that would have been now 0.5 there. It would have been massively different compared to the stupid accuracy I gave you at the start. So I gave you something to six decimal places to begin with, which you think Nobody ever works to more than two or three decimal places. But I've given you six decimal places. After six goes, I've no idea where I am. And also, if that last six digit was different, I'd have had a massive difference in the end result here. It's a bit like me starting this with a tiny, tiny difference here, but the bottom one flipping in completely the opposite direction after a few seconds of its motion. There. We can't predict what the future is, according to Laplace, Poincaré, unless we know to infinite accuracy where we start, and that's a ridiculous demand on us there. We can never do that. So we have complete loss of information there, and tiny changes leading to big differences. That's the sensitive dependence on initial conditions. So it's a little toy that we can use, and the numbers are irrelevant, it's just about shifting things along. And here's the rub. Typical behaviour is random, because typical numbers, I can go around the room and say, give me a number between 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, I'll write down what you say, so I'll just type randomly 0.274, blah, 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 random. If I apply my rule to that, my motion is random. And I'm going to call that chaotic there. And here's this even stranger thing. Within chaos, and this is one of the symptoms of chaos, there is order. Oops. Because there are things that don't move, like 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3. There are things that land on them after a number goes 2, 3, something random, 0.37, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. After three goes is 1, 1, 1, 1 forevermore. Call them pre-images. There are things which are periodic. 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. 3, 8, 7, 3, 8, 7, 3, 8, 7, 3, 8, 7. Periodic orbits, we'll call them. These are nice regular planet-like orbits, as it were, going around the centre. And things would land on them. So random stuff at the front, 0.628, just pick that randomly, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1. After three goes, you're on 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1. So this little toy has all sorts of weird things. It's got random behaviours, it's got periodic behaviours, it's got things which are eventually periodic, and a whole host of other interesting behaviours as well, which are typical of what goes on in mechanical models of the real. I'll skip this one here, other than to say this is showing us Poincaré's fortuitous phenomenon as well. Things can start close together, as they do there, with 10 decimal figures the same, but then the future is very, very different in my little toy. So again, we can start lots of different starting points close together, but the end game will be very different. It could be very different. A bit of history about this. Well, in the 1960s, the meteorologist, Ed Lorenz, was trying to model the weather, and he was trying to solve some equations of motion that were trying to model his weather, and he threw them away because he thought it was rubbish, what he was getting out of it. But then he had the courage of his convictions and realised that it wasn't rubbish what he was getting, but it was an inherent property of his model of the weather, the very simplified model. And as it happens, this butterfly-like shape was some kind of trajectory that he drew to show what the various variables were doing. We've seen this picture before now. You spend a lot of time downstairs, a lot of time upstairs. That corresponds to whizzing around either the left or the right-hand side of this strange attractor, as he called it. And this is when the word chaos came to the fore as this phenomenon, rediscovering Poincaré's work, essentially, of 60 years or so before. And in dynamics and mechanics, you see all sorts of strange shapes like this in when you follow the trajectories of various objects moving, weather, planets. This picture down the bottom here is a bit, it's actually you get from some one of the planets, one of the satellites of Mercury behaves in it's sort of potato shaped and tumbles around in a very strange way. If you try to plot its aspect, then it behaves in a very, very strange way. It goes around elliptically around the planet, but its orientation is very, very strange indeed because of its strange geometry. But lots of strange things occur in Newtonian mechanics. And that leads us on to the fractal geometry of nature. So I'll just give you a quick whistle-stop tour of this. This is a picture I took in Asda, Chandler's Ford, of a Romanesco broccoli. I didn't take this one. This is a fern leaf. And I like these two objects because they have the property that if you take a little bit of one of them, take this fern leaf and take one of the, I think they've got fronds, one of those bits there, it looks like the whole thing in miniature. Or if you take this Romanesco broccoli and take one of these florets off it, blow up the picture, it looks like the whole thing again there in miniature. And over two or three scales at length, then these objects here are have this idea of self-similarity, that you see the whole thing in miniature in a small part of it. And it, the particular, the fern is a classic example of this. If you take one of the leaves of it, then it has sub-leaves of it, and the whole picture looks like the original. And in nature, we have that. We have trees, where you have a trunk, of course, branches, and small branches, and small branches, and small branches there. Yep. Our lungs themselves have this branching process there. A river, where the water comes into a river. This is a colour. Tributaries. Yeah, the tributaries of the river. This is colourised here. But the tributaries on the tributaries, the smaller little sub-tributaries, have this kind of scaling phenomenon around them. A lightning bolt is a classic example as well, where you've got it's not a straight line. It's this jagged thing with bits coming off the side, and the bits coming off the side have bits coming off the side. Clouds, likewise, clouds are not spheres. Clouds are not sort of shoebox, rectangular type objects. They're these kind of wispy things. And when you zoom into a little bit of it, there it looks like a wispy thing that might look like the whole cloud. In fact, one of the grandfathers of fractal geometry, Benoit Mandelbrot, one of his favourite things was to talk about clouds there. We don't know how big that picture is. That could be a kilometre across, it could be 100 metres across, it could be 10 metres across. And when you took a little piece of it, the idea is you see the same thing, this sort of strange thing here. But nature is not Euclidean in geometry. Here's a great picture from 1820s, the great wave off Kanagawa. Mount Fuji in the background there. This is now one of the icons of chaos and fractals. The idea is you've got a great big wave, and you've got a couple of smaller big waves coming off it. But off those, there are others. The idea is that there are waves on the waves on the waves, and this is the idealized model of a great wave there. Classic picture, often overlooked. These poor chaps here, who are in these boats, who are about to receive their comeuppance when this wave crashes down upon them there. These fishermen here, there's a whole host of these pictures. I saw one in the British Museum. There was an exhibition just last year, actually. That cost them £120,000. This is a print from a woodcut. They're printed from, it's a woodblock print there, and there are very few of them around today. I think I read just yesterday that the most expensive one went for $1.5 million. These off-prints, in their day, they went for the price of a bowl of noodles. These prints from this wood block. British Museum's got a couple of them, but this is the best one they've got there. But it is a great icon of chaos and fractal geometry, this crashing wave here. But the thing that gets me is the waves on the waves on the waves that are on that picture. Here's a little GIF, zooming in. It's a bit slow, this one, to show you what I mean by seeing the whole thing in miniature within the whole thing. And we're zooming into this little harbour, this little bay here, and you'll see, oh, we seem to be zooming into another little bay within that picture there. And, look, there's this little bay is going to reveal itself here in that big picture there. And, oh, look, there's a little bay revealing itself within that picture there, and so forth. This is the idea of fractal geometry, seeing the whole in miniature the whole thing in miniature when you zoom in. Or a pizza. Looking at that bit of pepperoni there, zooming in, you see the whole pizza, which turns into a little bit of pepperoni or something, zooming in, seeing it again. Now we can zoom into regular geometric objects. It's boring. If I take a straight line, and take a bit of a straight line, it looks like a straight line. If I take a bit of that straight line, it looks like a straight line. That's a pretty boring thing to say. But these are special geometric objects, because only at certain length scales does it look like the original picture. Likewise, I go back to my picture of a lightning bolt, then you've got the big central strand there, then you've got the sub-strands. If I were to chop off and show you that picture at the side there, there would be a certain magnification which would make it look like the original. That's the same sort of thing that's going on with our pizza there. And Salvador Dali's been there. Visage of War, 1940. He was much shaken by the Spanish Civil War, of course now we're in the start of the Second World War, but this is Dali's comments at the time. The idea of his horrendous face, but notice within the eyes and the mouth we've got a horrendous face. If you're close enough to the picture, you will see that within the eye, within the faces that are in the eyes and the mouth, there are faces within the eyes and the mouth of the face. And a little dot of paint will give the impression that within the eyes and the mouths, that are within the eyes and the mouths, within the eyes and the mouth, there are more pictures of this terrible skull here going on forever. This is an attempt to summarise some of the horror of war by Dali. So this idea of kind of recursion, self-similarity, is present, going back to the Japanese woodprint, going to Dali here, and things we see around us in nature. And here's a little cartoon from the New Yorker magazine, a guy selling little toy wind-up men. Here, around the corner, one of those little toy wind-up men is selling little toy wind-up men. And you can bet what's going to happen around the corner. There, one of those little toy wind-up men is selling even smaller wind-up men. This is fractal geometry that I'm talking about here. Here's another cartoon, New Yorker again. So here's me thinking of Claire, and here's Claire thinking of me, and she'll be thinking of me thinking of her, and blah, 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 blah. This is contentment here for somebody. This says here, self-similarity. Iteration leads to cartoon self-similarity there. This is the idea of fractal geometry here. So what I want to contend is that the ancient Greeks were phenomenal, and we still teach our kids today things about circle theorems and about Pythagoras' theorem, and it's still there. But we now have weirdness, fractal geometry around to help us explain the world around us as well. This room is pretty Euclidean, it's pretty ancient Greek. We've got lots of straight lines, squares, circles around us as well. But nature out there isn't like that. Nature's not as wild as my particular fractal there, but nature needs more than ancient Greek geometry to try to understand it, and this is what fractal geometry gives us. And I mentioned Mandelbrot a minute ago. He's famous for his Mandelbrot set. I won't say what it is, but it has this ability of zooming into it and seeing miniature copies of itself. We're going to see one in a second when we zoom in a bit deeper. There it is. I'm going to zoom out now to show the whole thing. And this is one of the icons of chaos here, the so-called Mandelbrot set. I had the pleasure of going having dinner with him once at a conference. He's a brilliant man. He's a genius, but with an ego to match it. But in this case, well-warranted ego. He's almost single-handedly responsible for bringing in the fractal geometry of nature into modern science, starting in the late 70s, all the way through the 80s and 90s there. There was a revolution, almost, of understanding how these objects appear in physics, mathematics, chemistry, biology, and other areas to help understand what's going on. And he coined the word fractal in the 1970s. These are our mathematical toys that we play around with. So I'm not pretending that this is nature, but what I'm saying is if you don't understand something like this pendulum here, you haven't got a chance of understanding the weather. If you don't understand these toys here, then you've not got a chance of understanding the fractal geometry of a lightning bolt or a cloud. And here's something which is an iteratively defined set. You take a triangle, you strike out the middle upside down third, and that gives you three triangles in black there. And those triangles, you strike out the middle upside down thirds. That produces nine triangles, the black ones. Then we do the same thing again, and the same thing again. And we produce an object which has infinite zooming ability. I've just made a new word up then. Zooming ability. And I'm zooming into the corner of it to show you the more and more fine detail of this fractal. Mathematicians have the luxury of going to the infinite and the infinitesimal. And that's what we're doing here. We're going into zooming in more and more to the bottom corner of that object there. Even more bizarrely, we can ascribe a dimension. Most things have got dimension 1 or 2 or 3. But this is a bit weird. This is some sort of intermediate. There's nothing spooky about this. This is just some quantity to measure how strange it is, and we can give it a dimension which turns out to be about 1.5. It's a bit more than a line, but a bit less than an area, a bit less than a plane. So it's something between line and a plane, this strange object here called Sierpinski's triangle, after the Polish mathematician Wacław Sierpinski. About 100 years or so ago, he was playing around with these things. Here's another version, Snowflake, Helga von Koch. Again, zooming into the top corner to show the infinite recursion. Basically, you start off with a triangle and on each straight edge, go for a little walk and put a little triangle. Make that, in this case, a six-pointed star. And then you've got all these straight edges. On each of those little straight edges, we'll go for a little walk to put a little triangle on that. And repeat and repeat and repeat. And this is the object that we get here. Again, this is one of our mathematical toys that we use to try to understand fractal geometry. Studied about 100 years or so ago. 3D versions of that, a pyramid version of the Sierpinski triangle, where we excavate an upside down pyramid in the middle, and that creates five pyramids there, one on the top and four around the side, and each of those pyramids we excavate an upside down pyramid in that as well, and repeat and repeat and repeat. Or take a cube and bore through square in the middle, left to right, top to bottom, front to center, and then of the remaining cubelets that exist, bore through front to back, left to right, top to bottom, and repeat, and you get a kind of like sponge-like thing. And this is a great model of a sponge, this object here that has got big holes, and it's got smaller holes, and smaller holes, and the smaller holes. And this is a nice mathematical toy. Again, if we can't understand these guys, then we've not got a hope of understanding more naturalistic objects. So, beyond mathematical toys, we turn to nature again. As I said, we play with our toys to try to understand things like dimension, crinkliness. One of a better word, we try to understand all these objects. Here's our fern again, my favourite object here. Again, just to show, it's actually not a real life fern. This is a mathematical fern. If I take this leaf at the top and just look at that and blow it up, it looks like the whole thing. Or if I take any one of the leaves, blow it up, it looks like the whole thing. So what we're doing nowadays, mathematicians are trying to understand how clouds are, how the lungs are, how trees are, how lightning bolts are, how catchment areas for rivers are, and so forth. Because it'd be a bad idea to think that a cloud is a sphere. It'd be a bad idea to think of a lightning bolt as a straight line, or a tree as a straight line, or a fern as some sort of rectangle or something like that. That's not what nature is. It's not ancient Greek Euclidean geometry. It's something different. And we have the tools of fractal geometry to try to help us explore these objects here. That's our real goal. And I want to end with an example, a technological example of this. So this is a mathematical fern. And here's my little picture to show you that the whole fern in black on the left is actually, you can make it to be thought of as this second blue picture, which is chop away the bottom two leaves, and then you've got this blue figure here, which actually looks like a slightly shrunken version of the original. And then I'm going to glue in this, in the middle picture here, another much, much shrunken copy of the whole original, and put it on the right there to make that one that I missed. And I'm going to take the whole thing again, shrink it down, and stick it on the left-hand side there. I'm going to take a tiny little branch at the bottom there as well. The idea of this here is that the whole picture of the fern is now going to be encapsulated by the rules that you devise for shrinking, which actually is just simple times it by a constant to shrink. Those who know a bit of mathematics, it's times it by a matrix to shrink a two-dimensional object into another object here. Just a simple small set of numbers which tells you how to go from the big picture to each of the small pictures. And the beauty of this is that if you know those numbers as to how much to shrink by, you can, instead of sending your friend across in Australia a picture of a fern leaf, you can send them those numbers. You can encode the picture of the fern by saying what numbers you need to draw these other smaller pictures. Not the pictures themselves, but the numbers that you need to do that drawing. And that's a phenomenal amount of saving in terms of the data that you're going to, rather than sending a few kilobytes or a few megabytes of data across to your friend over in Australia, you're going to just send him a dozen numbers, which is a pathetically small amount of data to send. So you can imagine the technological gift that gives us, that we can compress the image there from being several kilobytes or several megabytes here to just a few tiny kilobytes there, less than that even, a few bytes of information there, thousands of bytes saved. So if I want to send you a picture of a fern, I won't send you the fern. I'll send you the information, the rule, to get to these other bits of fern, and the rule as to how to reassemble it. And there's a guy called Michael Barnsley, an English mathematician, who took this on board seriously, and he made himself a company, a multi-million dollar company now in the States. He couldn't get a job in the UK, a tragic tale actually, in a university in the UK, but he went off to the States, set up himself a company called Iterative Function Systems, a multi-million dollar company. He got the job with Microsoft to encode their encyclopedia. The Microsoft Encarta encyclopedia was encoded using his fractal image compression technique. And the idea was, okay, I saw what you could do with a fern. That looks pretty natural. How about any old picture that I take And here's Lena. If you are an image compressor, you've got to use Lena, because she's the industry standard picture that you've got to use to show how good your technique is. And his idea was that you look for bits, you look for bits that look like other bits in your image. So a bit of Lena's hat there looks a bit like that picture or whatever that part of the component is there, a bit smaller. And on a very small scale, what you can do, and what Michael Marcy did, was write an algorithm to go searching throughout the picture for smaller versions of that particular part of the picture that you want to focus on. Thereby find the rules, much as I was trying to do for the fern, which is telling you how to go from the whole thing to the smaller thing. Obviously, this is only going to be done approximately, it's not a pure object here. But look at the compression ratios that you get here. Maybe you can't see the pixelation that goes on. If you compress it at a ratio of 6:1, then you're not saving very much. And it's no surprise that your image is still quite smooth. But using his technique, you can compress it at a ratio 80:1. Now, if you're near the front, you might be able to see a bit of pixelation and a bit of poor quality in the picture. But that's pretty good. If you've got a mobile phone, it's irrelevant, the difference there. If you can save eight at a ratio 80:1, the amount of data you're going to send to your friend down the wire, then you're saving a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of storage in your device that you've got there. And he invented this fractal image compression idea, taking a random image, taking any image, a photograph, subjecting it to his algorithm to compress at these phenomenal ratios here to do image compression. Even more, I mentioned that mathematicians have the luxury of going to the infinite and the infinitesimal. Photographs nowadays are pixels. We have so many pixels on our cameras. And so our pictures, if you can see this picture, end up with this staircasing effect on straight edges there. We have the pixelation effect. You can go beyond the real image by smoothing out, applying this algorithm beyond where it should really be applied, and smooth out the picture there. So in some sense, you can do better than the original, which is a weird sort of thing to say there, because the pixels that you've got in your original image can be smoothed out just by taking a few further steps of the iteration process. And so there's a question there, of course, is whether or not you actually really are going to get something which is faithful to the original, we assume, analog picture of real life versus the discrete picture in the pixelated version. And maybe you can't see this one, but again, this is a zoom in. On the left-hand side, those who are close might be able to see some terrible staircasing effect around Lena's hat there, and also around her eyes here. There's pixelation going on, but we can go beyond that and smooth it out. I don't think it comes out very well in the picture, but we smooth it out and got, quotes, a better picture than one that we deserve there. So it's real-life stuff turning fractal geometry into application. My interest is actually not in that. This is more that, as I said earlier on, the engineering side, exploiting the ideas and doing something with it. As an applied mathematician, I just want to understand what's going on around us, and so that's the idea for there. So here's to end the takeaway message. Is the universe like clockwork? The answer is no, it's like that. It's chaotic, which means we can't predict the future very well, which is, you might say, a very good thing for us all, for our sanity. And secondly, is the world made up of straight lines, squares and so forth? Is it Euclidean geometry? Is it ancient Greek geometry? No. The answer is nature is fractal in nature. And what mathematicians, physicists have been doing for the last 20, 30, 40 years or so is using our toys and our ideas to try to understand these facts here, try to do the best we can in terms of predicting the future, or saying why we can't predict the future, or understand the geometry of the world around us so that we can understand how the world speaks to us. So that's the end. Here's a little fractal word. You can go on the web and look at fractal word generator and type in your name and fractalize it. So I encourage you to go and get yourself fractalized. Okay, thank you. Thank you all.